Doing Parshat Ba'alotcha, we'll begin with a quick summary of our parsha. Our parsha really is so loaded that we should spend a few days on it. We don't have that, so we'll do a quick overview. Our parsha begins with the commandment of how the lamp, the oil lamp in the temple, was lit every evening. The three lamps to the right and the three lamps to the left were all facing the center lamp, and we'll discuss the idea behind that in a minute. The Levim are inaugurated into their service in place of the firstborns, and here we have a recounting and an explanation as to why the firstborn really were the chosen ones, and how all of this worked, as we will discuss next as we review the parasha with more depth. And then Hashem says the years of service are from 21 to 50 years old, and then they come back and they have a different job. They help out, but they don't have the set jobs they had earlier. And then we hit Shlishi, and suddenly in Shlishi, our parsha goes out of chronological order. The book of Bamidbar began with the second month after we left Egypt. The second month in the second year. And here we go back to the first month of the second year. So we have the concept that's clearly indicated in our parsha. En mukdam u'mocha b'Torah. That the Torah is not written in chronological order. The Torah has an order with specific meaning, but the point of the order of the parshiyos in the Torah is not to stick within chronological order, but the order that God saw fit to tell us what happened. Yes, let's wait till we review, okay? There's a machlokas Ibn Ezra and Ramban. May we say that wherever it makes sense to us, or can we only say that where Chazal indicated to us that the parshas are written out of chronological order? And then we have a recording that the Jewish people brought the Pesach offering that second year in the desert, and there were people who were defiled. They couldn't bring the Pesach offering, and they came and they said, why should we be left out? And God gave us the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni. And then we're at Revi, and the Talmud, the Parsha tells us the order of how they would camp and travel, which again is something that had been happening for over a year now, and for some reason the Torah saw fit to review with us how they would camp and travel, and we'll discuss why when we review it with more depth. And then God tells Moshe, make for yourself two silver trumpets. Moshe is going to be king. He's going to have trumpets to give messages to the people. And we are going to enter the land of Israel. And with these trumpets, they will blow as they pray as we enter the land of Israel and go to war. And the trumpets were part of the prayer procession together with the shofros. So this is all preparation in anticipation of entering the land of Israel. So we're almost there. And then we travel, our first traveling after the great revelation at Sinai, and we're headed to the land of Israel. We're almost there. We're rushing over there. And Moshe tells his father-in-law, come along, we're almost there. And Yisrael says, no. And Moshe says, yeah, stick with us. And in 3 days we make a tremendous journey. And here we have Shishi. God's cloud passes before us. And we have an upside down nun. And Chazal tell us that Shishi is a breaking point in the parasha, and it's a breaking point in the Chumash. Really, all of Bamidbar till that upside down nun is one book of the Torah. And then we have the psukim, Vayhi bin Soa Haron. Those two psukim, they are their own book of the Torah. And then we have another book of the Torah, which is the book of Bamidbar, from the next upside down nun onward. So how many books are there in the Torah? 7. So Tosfos asks, why do we call the Torah a Chumash, from the word Chamesh? Really, there are 7 books of the Torah. That's how we rule halachically. So that's a good question. And then the nation comes complaining. Such a huge journey in 3 days. God is rushing them. We're almost there. Don't ruin it now. They complain. And a fire comes, and people get killed, and the elders get killed, and Moshe prays, and the fire gets buried, sinks into the ground. And then the people start complaining. What are they complaining about now? They're saying, girls were so free out in Egypt. Here we have these laws of which girls were allowed to marry and who not. We remember the fish we had for free in Egypt. One understanding is they remembered the food that they could eat without any mitzvos. The other understanding is they remembered the women they could take without all the limitations of the Torah. They said things are not as sweet as they were back in Egypt. And Moshe hears it and he's upset and he says to God, why do you give me this responsibility? I can't handle this. We're almost there. We almost entered the land of Israel. We're footsteps away, another day or two. We're almost there. And the people start complaining and Moshe is upset. He says, did I give birth to these people? Where am I going to have all the meat they're asking for? They're asking for meat. I can't handle this alone. And if you're going to give me this job where I can't do it, so kill me, because I can't handle these people alone. And God says, okay, gather 70 men, and you'll have 70 elders to help you, and you'll have policemen to help you. You're not going to have to handle this alone. And tell the people they're going to have a special bird or fish or somewhere in between, a fish that has wings called tzlav, and they'll have all the meat they want. And Moshe says to God, you know, we're talking about 600,000 men alone, or are we going to slaughter sheep or cattle? Where are we going to have enough meat for all of them? And according to some opinions, this was one of Moshe's weightiest sins, questioning God over here. And God tells Moshe, you think I can't do it? You'll see. And Moshe tells the people, he gathers the 70 elders, they go out of the camp, and prophecy settles down on Moshe, and then like a candle lighting all the other candles, the 70 men with him, they get prophecy too. Now each tribe, you have 12 tribes, each tribe is supposed to give 6 representatives, but 2, right? 2 were supposed to give 5 representatives. Who was supposed to do it? So each tribe gave forward 6 representatives. You had 72 people standing there, and then they drew lots. And you had 72 lots. 70 of them were supposed to say prophet, and 2 of them were blank. So 2 people, Eldad and Medad, they got pieces of paper that said prophet on it. But then they looked, and they saw 70 people going out of the camp. So they said, someone's cheating. Someone's not telling that they got a white note. But we're not going to embarrass anyone. They stayed inside the camp. And God likes when people are careful not to hurt other people's feelings. So when prophecy settled in on the people outside the camp, Eldad and Medad inside the camp start prophesizing, which is a threat, because the idea of prophecy with Moshe outside the camp was that there are going to be 70 prophets, but they're all subservient to Moshe. Their prophecy comes by virtue of Moshe's strength. There will not be 70 leaders to the people. There's one Moshe, one leader, and 70 people under him who are also prophets. But they're all under Moshe. And here you have 2 people standing inside the camp, and suddenly they're saying, we have prophecy, and they're quoting their prophecy, and that seems to be an indication that they're prophets, and they're not subservient to Moshe. And now there's a threat to the unity of the people. How many people are going to lead the Jewish people? Moshe is a prophet, Aaron's a prophet, Miriam's a prophet. Okay, they've been working in cahoots just fine. All the prophecies seem to go only through Moshe. But here you have 2 people standing inside the camp, and they're saying, God just spoke to us and told us to tell you that. So Yeshua runs out of the camp. He just heard them say that Moshe is going to die and Yeshua is going to lead the people into Israel. Well, we're a matter of hours away from Israel, and Yoshua hears them saying, Moshe is going to die, Yoshua is going to lead them in. So he runs out to Moshe, and he tells him, Eldad and Medad, they're giving prophecy. I'm sorry, he wasn't the one that ran out. It says the lad ran out, and Yoshua was standing there. It was Moshe's son, Gershom. He runs out to Moshe, and he tells him, Eldad and Medad, they're not doing what God said. They're giving prophecy inside the camp. And Yeshua says, put them in prison. Yeshua is standing out there. He hears that that's what's being said. Moshe says, what, are you jealous for me? Hey, I don't mind if there are other prophets. I wish. Everyone should be prophets. Miriam is standing next to Aaron as all of this is taking place. And first, Miriam is standing next to Zipporah, Moshe's wife. And Zipporah looks at Miriam, her sister-in-law, and says, I feel bad for the wives of those 70 men. Miriam says, why do you feel bad? Tzipora says, if their husbands are going to be prophets, so they're never going to live as a family again. So Miriam says, what do you mean? Tzipora says, well, my husband Moshe, he got prophecy, and we sleep in separate beds. We're never together ever since he became a prophet. So if 70 other people are going to have prophecy now, there are another 70 wives who are not going to have their husbands. So Miriam says, oh. And she goes over to the big brother Aaron and says, Aaron, you got prophecy. I got prophecy. We still cohabitate with our spouses. We have to talk to Moshe. Why does he think that he has to separate from his wife when he's getting prophecy? And Hashem appears suddenly to Moshe, Aaron, Miriam, and says, get out. Leave the camp to Ohel Moed. And Aaron and Miriam, who were both defiled, they had both been with their spouses the previous night, and they hadn't yet gone to mikvah, they start yelling, water, water, we can't handle this, what holiness, and we're not pure. And Miriam breaks out in tzaras. When a person is thrown up into a higher level of spirituality and he's not fit for it, so then the body, so to speak, yells out, and Aaron and Miriam, they both break out with a heavy case of tzaras. They're both ash white. And God turns to them and says, here, please, listen what I have to tell you now. And they're yelling, Aaron and Miriam, they say, we can't, God, we need water, we can't handle this now. God says, listen, if any other prophet has prophecy, they see a vision, they see a dream. My servant Moshe is not like that. He's on a higher level. I speak to him face to face. I don't give him visions, but rather every word Moshe says is my word. There's no other prophet like that. How come you weren't scared to talk about my servant Moshe? And after God speaks to them gently and explains to them their error, only then does God get upset. We learn from that how we're supposed to rebuke. First, God speaks to them gently. They're on a very high level, but if a person is attacked, even a person on a high level, even a prophet like Aaron and Miriam, who are the highest prophets we had after Moshe, it seems. But even they, and even if it's God doing the talking, you can't argue, right? You can't say, no, you don't understand. Even there, God first speaks gently, explains to them their mistake, and only after that, Vayichar'af Hashem, God's anger goes out against them, and the cloud lifts, and Miriam is white as snow, and Aaron turns to Miriam, he sees she has tzaras, and he can only infer what he looks like. And Aaron turns to Moshe and says, please don't hold it against us, we messed up, we sinned, forgive us, don't let her be like a dead person, she's your sister. And Moshe calls out to Hashem a quick, short prayer, Hashem, please heal her. And Hashem tells Moshe, back in Egypt, when her father got upset at her and spat at her after they had to throw you into the Nile, wasn't she embarrassed for 7 days from her father? She was the one who kept saying that you'd be the great leader, and then when her prophecy seemed to be up in smoke, her father patted her on her head and spat and said, where's your prophecy now, my girl? And then for 7 days she was embarrassed. So now too, you know, I shouldn't be less than that when I'm upset at her. Let her wait outside the camp for 7 days. So we're about to enter the land of Israel, and we don't. We wait 7 days until Miriam can rejoin our camp. And then we make the next journey, which is about to take us into the land of Israel. And that brings us to the end of our parasha. So now let's look at it with more depth. Yes?
You used the term, say, Moshe got upset. Softly, is this just embellishing
of
the narrative?
It is the Rabbeinu Eliyahu Mizrahi's interpretation of Rashi over there. And it's not his own. He is working off of a Midrash over here. The Midrash says that obviously Hashem doesn't get angry, but what Hashem revealed to them was first Hashem spoke to them in terms that to them were soft so that they could hear it. And then Hashem spoke to them in a way that showed His anger. But only after they understood the point. And from here we're supposed to learn this lesson.
I don't get that. I understand that you should speak softly first. But if you understand, then why would you get angry?
Hashem's anger isn't like our anger. Hashem's anger is more an indication of where Hashem holds the person to be holding. Hashem's anger leaves an imprint. It's not letting off steam. When we say Hashem got angry, we mean Hashem revealed to them that they did something which was deserving of anger.
First they understood that they did wrong, and then they got punished.
Right.
But they understood why.
Right. And from here we infer that you cannot expect a person to think logically and rationally and understand you, even a great person, and even when you're 100% in the right, if you begin with anger. How often do we have something to say? We're steaming at our sibling, at our parent, at our spouse, and we walk in shooting off. Well, if you're walking in shooting off, you haven't learned this lesson.
We also learned that if you do something wrong, you should accept punishment.
Fine, but you see that God didn't expect them to be able to hear Him out once they saw God was upset. Yes.
Is there, do you know the opinion that says there's only 6 books in the Holy Torah?
No.
For 3. Everything up to the end, then between the ends, and then after.
Don't know. I don't know. Okay. You want something?
Yes, Rabbi. Why? Like, I know the Torah isn't written in chronological order, but why does this come after this, what happened in the first in Esau? And then suddenly we are jumped to this. Why?
Okay, so we'll deal with that in a minute. Okay? Hashem tells Moshe how Hashem wants the candles, the lamp lit in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan at that time. Whenever we have physical application of service of Hashem, so we have to understand that we're dealing with Kabbalistic concepts. And the border between what's right and wrong is very fine, because whenever you're dealing with something physical, then you run the risk of entering idol worship. The only way we could do something physical in the service of Hashem is when Hashem says so. And so, when Hashem tells us things, we understand that there's a message for us behind the physical. There's something we're supposed to take away from it. The menorah represents God's light to us. Although God tells us to light the menorah in the evening, according to Maimonides, it was also lit every morning, God doesn't need the light from the menorah. God gave enough light for 2 million people in the desert every night. So He didn't need our little 7 lamps over there in the holy. But God is giving us a vessel which is an indication of God's shining light through us. And in that vessel, when we light the menorah, the Torah tells us, take the 3 lamps to the left and have them facing center, and the 3 lamps to the right. And Chazal tell us that left and right are a reference to the way people balance their lives. There are people who focus on Torah, they are called in Chazal the Maiminim, those who go to the Yamin, to the right. There are people who spend most of their time focused on the physical, they have to work making a parnasa. They are called in Chazal the Masmeilim, those who are on the left. And the Torah says, those on the left and those on the right must all focus to the center. You will notice that when we accepted the Torah, no one said, E'ese ve'eshma, I will do and I will hear. Everyone said, Na'ase ve'nishma, we the plural, we the Jewish people. Every individual had a recognition that his capacity to perform the Torah was not resting on his shoulders alone. The only way that we can keep the Torah is if we do it as a whole. Meaning those that are learning Torah, they need those that are working, and those that are working, they need those that are learning Torah. Every person's supposed to work somewhat, and every person's supposed to learn Torah to the best of their capacity. But at the end of the day, you're going to have the Maiminim and the Masmilim, those that are more to the right and those that are more to the left. Those are doing more work and more Torah. And everyone together said, Na'aseh, together we will do. The menorah focusing to the center embodies this concept that we together we get the light of Hashem when we are all united. And so too the menorah was fashioned from one solid piece of gold because again, the menorah represents our unity. There's a medrash that says that Moshe couldn't figure out how to make this intricate menorah out of one solid piece of gold. So, one opinion says that he threw it into fire, he threw a slab of gold into the fire, and then God fashioned the menorah.
And if we say that someone cast a piece of gold and something came out from that, it's like it's compared to Chet Egel, no?
Okay, I hear.
Which is very interesting because many things, as I've said, it seems that they're ke'ilu close of the Zara, right? But like Chetness, you know, and all the things that happen in temple, like even going down, that we discuss about the floor that cannot be tiled for.
Hashem then tells Moshe, take the Levim from among the Jewish people and purify them. And part of the purification process was sprinkling the waters of the golden heifer. And part of it was that they'd shave all their hair off. And the idea here is that the Levim are going to come in to serve Hashem instead of the firstborn. What is the role of the firstborn? So let's rewind. In Egypt, the firstborn were an idol. They were considered gods in Egypt. And God, when He punished the Egyptians, so God took their idol, the Nile, they worshipped the Nile, and turned that into blood. And slowly but surely, Hashem destroyed Egypt, until Hashem said, the final plague, I will destroy the gods of Egypt and their firstborn. The firstborn were whom? They were also gods in Egypt. They worshipped the firstborn. The firstborn is also the representative of the family. The firstborn in those times was considered the prime son. He was the continuum at the head of the family after the father. So the firstborns were considered like the representative of the family. Now, God is punishing the Egyptians, and technically the Jews in Egypt were pagans like the Egyptians. We were evolving into monotheism, but the angels said, why are the Egyptian firstborns dying and not the Jewish firstborns? The Jewish firstborns were also worshipped in Egypt. They also deserve to die. And then God said, technically, in order to save the firstborns, I have to give them a special godly pardon. How do I give them a godly pardon? I take them into my service. They're my soldiers. If they're my soldiers, then no one can touch them. So God said, from here on in, the firstborn sons of the Jews in Egypt, they're like the firstborn animals. Just like the firstborn animals are holy, you're not allowed to work with them, you have to give them to the temple, so too every Jew and his family will take his firstborn and dedicate him to the temple. You're not allowed to accept any service from them. The firstborn in Egypt are my servants from now on. So then the angels are told, no touching the firstborn Jews. They're God's servants now. So the firstborn had a role. They were supposed to do all kinds of service in the temple. We leave Egypt and comes time for the golden calf. Where are God's servants when it comes to the golden calf? The firstborns are worshipping just like everyone else. Who is not worshipping the golden calf? The Levim, the Levites. And so now God says, the firstborns can no longer be my servants. Now I'm going to relinquish my rights over the firstborn. I'm putting them back as regular citizens. But that's because the Levim will come in their stead. The Levim have shown their faithfulness to me. So the procession of inaugurating the Levim into the service of Hashem That procession involved the Levim shaving all their hair, immersing in the mikvah, purifying their clothing, and the special sacrifice. And the Jews would place their hands on the Levim, and then Aaron would lift each Levi and wave him, so to speak, in the honor of Hashem. And then the Levim got holiness that was eternal holiness. What's the idea of shaving all the hair? So, the firstborn were disqualified because they had served the golden calf. Well, serving the golden calf is idol worship. And idol worship is like, is referred to as sacrifices to the dead. And a person who has the white blemish, tzaras, is also called dead. So we have this equation where tzaras equals dead equals idol worship. A person who has tzaras, when he comes to become purified, must shave all his hair. So too, these Levim who were coming in place of the Jews who did idol worship, which is like tzaras, also had to shave all their hair. Why is this relevant? Because halachically today, if a person is pagan, let's say a person is converting from Christianity to Judaism, so we say that that's considered like he's left something which is somewhere along the lines of paganism. So we say that before he immerses in mikveh, he has to do like the Levim did. He should take a close haircut. He should shave his hair and his beard. Many places don't have this custom anymore, but this custom is quoted in the Ramban, Shulchan Aruch, based on this Rashi in our Parsha, that before a person goes to mikveh, he takes a close haircut. The Levim would actually shave all their hair. It seems like once upon a time, that was the custom, that a person would shave all his hair. Now this was even the case if a person... if a person was Jewish, but then he left the fold, he behaved like a pagan, he joined a pagan cult for a few years, and then he did tshuva. So it says in Shulchan Aruch that the custom is that we wouldn't allow him to join a minyan. We wouldn't let him back until he shaved his hair and went to mikvah, and then he could join a minyan. That's based on this Rashi. Technically, there's no basis for that. You know, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. If he sinned, it's between him and God. At the end of the day, he's a Jew. Now that he does tshuva, what's the problem in letting him join a minyan? So it's not like that. It's such a strong minhag that the Ramban, the laws of Chol HaMoed, where it's discussed that you're not allowed to take a haircut, there's a rabbinic prohibition against taking a haircut or taking a shave on Chol HaMoed. Over there, the Ramban says, but wait, what about this guy? You can't let him join a minyan. He's not doing his part of Judaism until he does this. So that's where it's discussed in Aruch Chaim, in the laws of Chol HaMoed, and in Yerodea. Yes?
Does anyone know if in the time of the Middle Ages, the Crusaders, if they made them do that?
I don't know.
Jewish people, if people fell from making that?
Don't know.
You said they shaved their head. Like, was it enough to keep pious?
I would assume so, because payas is a biblical prohibition. By the Levim, not. But here, where it's just the minhag, where we're trying to understand the minhag based upon a Rashi in our parsha, so I don't think they would transgress a biblical prohibition for that.
So that's also my question. When it comes to Tatsuriya, all the hair should be removed, even the eyelashes, even the eyebrows. So
seems like it was the same thing. Yeah.
So everything should be removed, no?
That's what it would seem, but we don't do that today. Today, what we do is we do a close shave and a close haircut, and even that, not every court does that. Some have the custom and some don't.
But back then, can we say that since Tatsuriya, since the purification for Tatsuriya,
it's Mitzorah,
mitzvah, yes, it's a mitzvah taseh, therefore not to cut peyot is also mitzvah taseh.
But here there is no mitzvah. It's a custom that our first source for it is in Rashi. We don't know where it comes from. We say it comes from this Rashi.
No, I'm talking about I'm not talking about Levim. I'm talking about when people had
The Ger, the Gior.
No, when people had Metzorah.
So, yeah. So over there, yeah.
So if that's mitzvah taseh, and also it's mitzvah taseh not to cut peyot, so how can we have two mitzvah taseh?
I think over there the Talmud says they did cut it all off.
Yeah.
Over there, I think.
Can a mitzvah taseh overrule another mitzvah taseh?
And a say overrules a lotaseh. Over there, it's a lotaseh.
Lotaseh. Lotaseh. Okay, I have another question. sorry. Let's see if I understand. It's written in the Parashat Pekudei. I don't know if the Parashat Pekudei says that Moshe he lighted the candles of menorah. I'm not sure if it's literal or not. Because in many places it said, and Moshe built, and Moshe did, and Moshe he didn't build the Mishkan. It seems so. So, but it's written Parashat Pekudei, and he lighted candles. It's,
let's talk about it after class. We'll look at it and we'll see. So the Levim, on the one hand, they volunteered themselves, and on the other hand, they're also the Jewish people's representatives. Because the Jews have to give the Levim their tithe, so they're funding them. And then the Levim service is really representative of all of Israel. So the Levim, they start their service. And we said they work from 25 through 50. Another pasuk says from 30 to 50. So the Talmud says in Chulin, from here we see that if you want to give learning Torah a shot, you give it a 5-year shot. After 5 years, then you can gauge whether you're cut out for Torah or not. But you got to give it 5 years, because the Levim had 5 years training. Gemara in Chulin, Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph. And if you look closely in Rashi, let's see, do we have a Gemara Chulin? There's a very interesting Rashi there. Mara says like this. Mikan de talmid shelo ra siman yafe b'mishnato 5 shanim shuv eino ro'eh. From here we see that a student who has not succeeded in getting his Mishnah, that everything he learns he keeps forgetting. So if he didn't get it in 5 years, every time he learns he keeps forgetting everything he learned, so then he's not going to get it.
What does that mean?
Huh?
What does that mean? He forgets everything?
He forgets everything.
He can't remember anything.
So you should get a job in that situation,
no?
So where from started for job?
So doesn't say exactly how. It says if he keeps learning and forgetting, he doesn't feel like he's getting anywhere. Let's say if in 5 years he couldn't pass that, he's not going to. But there's a Rashi which I'm not seeing now. Give me 1 second. So, I don't remember where it is.
Could this be based on the fact that in the time of the Amoraim, getting into the academy was like memorizing all of Mishnah? Was that kind of the kind of learning that they're talking about here?
They were talking about being able to remember the Mishnah they learned.
All like memorizing like all of Mishnah.
Doesn't have to be all of Mishnah. It has to be that you see you're making headway. Person has to see, am I getting anywhere? I'm learning, I'm reviewing. Some people are not cut out for it. You have people who can sit and learn and review and learn and review, and after 5 years they haven't made any substantial headway. I haven't seen many people like that, but there are people like that. I used to tutor. I remember there was a kid who every week we'd start at the same point. He'd sit and stare at me and concentrate, and by the end of our learning he could repeat everything and he could answer questions about everything we learned, and then we'd come to the next session and he knew nothing. It's like start from scratch. So I did this a second time and a third time, and then I said to the parents, I don't know if it's him or it's me, but this shidduch isn't working, because you know, after 3 times get someone else. We're not getting anywhere. There are people like that, but the general populace, if you work at something, you'll see you've made headway, you've advanced. You do remember. You don't remember everything, but you're making headway. But you want to gauge yourself. So from here we see the time to gauge yourself is 5 years. Give yourself 5 years and see what you've gotten in 5 years. The Levim would spend 5 years learning, huh? Because in one place it says the Levim started working at age 25, the other place it says at age 30. And we say, what does it mean? Which one is it, 25 or 30? So we say at 25 they started their training. At 30 they started the service. You see, they needed 5 years of training to do the work in the Beit HaMikdash.
So meanwhile they did what?
They were studying. They were learning the laws.
Up to 25? No.
25 to 30. No, up to 25. I don't know what they did up to 25. Maybe they were learning Torah or helping their parents. I don't know. Yes?
I read a Scientific American that supposedly you need 10 years to be an ordinary master at something.
Okay.
Diligent work.
Okay. We didn't say you could be a master after 5 years. We said after 5 years you could gauge whether you're getting anywhere. And then we hit Shlishi. And when we hit Shlishi, suddenly the Torah goes rewind. Goes back a month. And the idea here is that we're holding by entering the land of Israel. We're about to enter. And so the Torah is setting us up, explaining to us what had to happen before we entered. So the Torah told us in last week's parsha how they ordered the flags. And the Torah here tells us how the Levim were set up so they could know who's carrying the Mishkan and how who's responsible for what in the Mishkan. And we saw earlier in last week's parsha the order of holiness of the camp that's going to enter the land of Israel. And we had the commandments of getting dealing with a bastard or a woman who her husband suspects that she is committing adultery, because we're about to enter the land of Israel, so we have to have a holy camp. We're entering the holy land. So the Torah told us, how do you ensure your camp is holy? Well, take care of any problems of adultery and things like that. And then the Torah here at Shlishi rewinds and recounts point number one, our Paschal offering. Point number two, the inauguration of the Mizbeach. Point number three, the Levim's preparation. And point number four, the order of our camping, which is something that's been happening for over a year. The Torah wants to show us our merits. That the Jewish people were on a high level spiritually and they deserved to enter the land of Israel. Look at the temple they erected. Look at how quick they were to do what God said about appointing the Levim, even though it meant that they would lose their own representative in the temple. Look at how careful they were to bring the Paschal offering just before they entered the land of Israel, or were about to enter. And then the Torah tells us how they camped and traveled, and the Torah here is telling us some insight. The Torah is telling us sometimes they'd come to a place and it was very comfortable. They'd set up camp, they'd have everything ready, and they'd have everything set up just the way they wanted. And then come morning and the cloud rises and it's time to go. No one complained, nothing. They packed their bags, they went. Sometimes they'd camp in a place, they didn't even have time to unpack, to set up their animals, to do anything. And the next morning the cloud says, we're traveling again. Sometimes they'd come to a place and it was very difficult to live there. There wasn't adequate supplies for their family and their animals and everything. And they had the money, they had the water, but it wasn't easy camping there. And suddenly the cloud settles and doesn't budge for a period. And no one's telling them how long they're going to stay there. So they stay and they don't budge. They don't say, well, down there's a nice oasis, let's go visit there. So when the Torah recounts to us the order of traveling, that it was all based upon the clouds, and sometimes they stayed longer and sometimes they stayed shorter, the Torah is telling us a level of piety that the Jewish people were on. It wasn't very convenient to lead your life this way. You don't know what day you're packing, what day, how long you're staying for. Go live life like this. It's not even a normal nomadic tribe. It's a nomadic tribe where the leader doesn't tell you what the plan is. And you just got to be ready at any moment. He's going to tell you, go. And you might stay at a place like we stayed at Sinai for a whole year, and he didn't tell you to go. And sometimes it's not so comfortable to stick around where he tells you, and you just stay. And that's what Am Yisrael did.
That's the spirit also.
What?
Also brings spirited people.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's spirit. It seems they're desperate. Not maybe not for the foods, but because if you have like if you're stuck in a certain place or time, you're not knowing where you're going to, like. You get spirit.
Okay. Moshe tells Hashem tells Moshe to review the laws of the Pesach before the Korban Pesach, and this is halacha. We say 30 days before each holiday, you have to start reviewing the halachos of that holiday. We say that you should even review the prayers before Yom Tov, so you know what you're about to say. It's a way of life. So if you guys would ask me, I'd say that now's a perfect time to start learning the laws of blow and shofar, shaking lulav and esrog, and building a sukkah. And you'll ask me why. So ask me why. Oh, so the I learned this from Rabbi Gun. Yeah. the idea is that you're going to come back here Elul, and suddenly you'll say, I have to prepare. So I have to prepare to do tshuva because Yom Kippur's coming. I have to prepare for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, all at once. How are you going to do that? How are you going to learn the halachas? You know, there's a whole tractate Rosh Hashanah, there's a whole tractate Yuma, there's a whole tractate Sukkah, there's a whole tractate Beitza on the laws of Yom Tov, there's a whole tractate Moed Katan on the laws of Chol Moed. You walk in the beginning of the year, you have 30 days during which you have to focus on tshuva, you have to get acclimated to your classes and everything else, and during that time, you're also going to get ready with the laws you need to know for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Chol Moed. How are you going to do that? So, Chacham Enav Birosho, a wise person thinks in advance, and he says, okay, Tisha B'Av and the 9 days and the 3 weeks are coming up. Who knows, maybe by then we'll have Beis HaMikdash. But just in case we don't, how long does it take to prepare for that? 1 day, 2 days, 3 days? I'll do that when I get there. But now I have a period of 4 or 5 months where I don't have any holidays. So what am I going to do during this period? Prepare for the holidays that come up, because when Rosh Hashanah suddenly comes, when suddenly the month of Elul, and if you're Sfardi, you're saying Slichos every morning, so you're half asleep the rest of the day. If you're Ashkenazi, so you're not saying Slichos every morning, but you're trying to do Tshuva, and you hear the shofar blowing, and you're trying to be good about your classes, and it's not easy. How are you going to get the halachas in then? So the trick is to start now. Start preparing now for the month of Tishrei, for the month of Elul. And then when it'll come in, you'll have little things to pick up. You'll say, okay, now I'll do the laws of Chol HaMoed. Now I'll do the laws of, maybe the laws of Yom Tov, or the laws of visiting the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Tov, or whatever there is. So Moshe did a review with the Jewish people. In ancient times, the rabbis would give speeches. People would take off for a month by Nisan, people would take off for a month by Tishrei, to learn all the laws. They were called Yarchei Kala. And the rabbis would give speeches on Shabbos. Before Pesach, you have Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, where they'd give a whole long speech about all the halachas of the Yom Tov. Before Yom Kippur, you have a Shabbos Shuvah Drasha. Okay, and then we have the laws of Pesach Sheni. And then... Yes?
Rashi says about the pasuk that says... in its appointed time, he says that even in a state of impurity. So what does that mean? Because how does that coincide with the fact that people who are in a state of impurity can't participate in the Paschal?
From here we derive that there's a concept of tumah hutra b'tzibur. If the majority of the congregation is defiled, then they may bring a Korban Pesach. This is a concept called tumah hutra b'tzibur. The tumah was permitted over here. That's what Rashi is referring to. It is permitted to bring a Pesach offering. Let's say all of Israel gathered for war. So everyone's tameh. How are you going to bring your Pesach offering? So we say, tumah utra b'tzibur. And there were occurrences in history where they actually did this.
Is that saying that aside from the Paschal offering, if you were in a state of impurity in the majority, then you wouldn't be able to bring an offering? Like,
again?
Why do we have to learn that that's allowed?
Because any other offering can't be brought in a state of defilement. You're not allowed to go into the Beit HaMikdash when you're defiled. Uh-huh. When you're tameh, you can't do anything. There's a special din that if the majority of the congregation is tameh, then we do permit certain korbanot.
Why not add another Adar month? So Pesach would be postponed.
That might be a good reason to add another month. It's something the courts would have to consider. The Torah tells us with the trumpets, when there's war, blow the trumpets and be commemorated before Hashem, be remembered before Hashem. And from here we have the concept that we're supposed to turn to Hashem at a time of need. It is a biblical obligation when a person has something trying in his life to turn to Hashem. There's a machlokes Rambam Ramban, whether there's an obligation to pray every day or not. Do we say once a day you must pray biblically, or do we say no? You don't have to pray every day biblically. That's a rabbinic institution to pray once a day, three times a day. Biblically, you only have to pray what it says in our parasha. When a bad thing happens, when there's a danger, so you recognize God is running the world, you turn to Him in prayer. Some want to say that even Maimonides, who says you must pray once a day biblically, he agrees with the concept of Nachmanides that technically, biblically, you only have to pray in a time of danger. He only feels that we should recognize that the human condition is so fragile that every day is its own danger. So every day, at least once a day, you got to talk to God. That's how some want to explain. We're short on time, so let's talk after class. And so we travel towards the land of Israel. Moshe tries to convince his father-in-law to come. Ultimately, his father-in-law does come, and his grandchildren become great rabbis, the leading rabbis of the Jewish people. The nation complains, and it's the nature of people to complain, specifically when you do the biggest favor to them. The Chassam Sofer has a letter in which he writes, "I don't know why this person hates me. I never did him any favors." That's the nature of humanity. When someone does us something good, we usually hate him for it. So God did us a big favor. He took us this great long journey. He did it very fast so we'd get to the land of Israel quicker, and the nation complains about it. At this time, the elders who deserved to die already earlier for trying to see beyond what they could see spiritually at Sinai, they tried to understand concepts of God that were beyond their perception, and they should have dropped dead then. God didn't want to do it then, but at this point they died. The nation complains that they remember the free fish they had in Egypt. That's what you remember from Egypt, your free fish. You don't remember they killed your children. You don't remember you were beaten. That is the nature of the beast. That is the nature of the human being. Wherever we are, we think back and we remember what was good about it. And this happens often in dating too. You date a girl and you say, hey, this doesn't make sense. And then you stop and you go on to the next girl. And the next girl makes even less sense. So then you think back and say, gee, that was pretty good. Maybe I should go back to that. It doesn't work that way. We often think back and remember only what was good. Our sages say when the Jewish people were complaining about the laws of families, that the Torah limits who we may marry, this was an indication that we accepted this mitzvah with fighting. We didn't accept this mitzvah with joy like we accepted the mitzvah of milah. And that's why our sages say ever since this period, whenever we have a bris milah, we make a party, everyone's happy. The poor kid just had an operation, but we're all happy, because we've always done this mitzvah with happiness. But when it comes to the mitzvah of marriage, we complained in our parsha, we've always been complaining. That's why Chazal say, "Deletchatuna delo ramia batigra." There's no wedding without a fight. Can't have a wedding without a fight, because the Jewish people never accepted it with joy. The laws of marriage is something that we accepted, and it was tough for us to accept. And so ever since then, it's been tough for us to accept. So every wedding is going to have its own issues.
Loss of Tarat Mishpacha?
I didn't say Tarat Mishpacha.
I'm asking.
I didn't say that, no. So I said what I meant. The laws of which women we may and may not marry. We have to stop now because we're out of time. How many people would like to learn...